Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Listen to Fresh Off the Field on your favourite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Marlo, Bulavanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It is Wednesday, November 12. Thanks for tuning in for another edition live from Melbourne, the home of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up today, COP30 is underway, but with a lack of Pacific leaders, is it losing its influence? Also, survivors in Timor-Leste gather to remember a dark chapter in their nation's history.
That day, the Indonesian military attacked us without mercy. I remember the fear, the confusion.
And could the Kumuls face England ahead of the Rugby League World Cup next year?
The majority of our Kumul side will be over in England, so I think that would be a great hit out for both teams as a preparation to the World Cup.
A great hit out indeed. All that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, Australia and New Zealand's willingness to pay top dollar for recreational drugs is turning Pacific Island states into drug mules for cartels. A new government report outlines how gang members, many of whom are deportees, are transporting shipments of meth and cocaine through the islands, often with the help of corrupt police and customs officials who are paid to look the other way. What's worse, these gang members are being paid for their efforts with drugs of their own, which they go on to sell in Pacific communities. The stark details have been revealed in New Zealand's Ministerial Advisory Group on Transnational Serious and Organised Crime's most recent report. The group's chair, Steve Simon, told me the quantities of drugs getting into Australia and New Zealand via the Pacific are incomparable to anything that's been seen before.
For New Zealand, for example, the amount of methamphetamine our customs service stopped at our border over the entire of 2014 is the same amount they currently stop every week in the last year. And so what we're talking about is a scale which is far beyond anything anyone had ever anticipated. And what we're seeing now is we could almost reliably count on the drugs that were coming into New Zealand were coming through Asia, often transiting through Australia. Whereas now we'll just open up this gateway through the Americas, up through North America, down through the Pacific and into New Zealand and Australia. So we're talking about a scale which we couldn't have conceived of before.
We'll get to those gateways, particularly through the Pacific, in just a second. But before we get to that, why is it so much more? Is it due to an increased demand within Australia and New Zealand for drugs?
We certainly have a healthy percentage of our populations who are willing to consume recreational drugs, but also it's the price that we are willing to pay. We're probably up there in terms of the price we pay for drugs like methamphetamine and cocaine. So we're paying record-leading prices for it, which means it's driving the demand.
Now, deportees have been at the centre of a lot of the trafficking within the Pacific Islands. We've reported in the last 12 months about how criminal gangs like the Comancheros have even opened up chapters in places like Tonga. But I want to ask you, how do they actually go about facilitating the shipments of these drugs? Like, do they serve as middlemen? Are they distributors within the islands? Or are they there to basically sort of move the shipments on?
Bit of everything. What we're seeing is that some of those drugs seem to be stopping and being either used as payment for those who are assisting them in the Pacific. And so what you're seeing is in the Pacific, it's sprung up their own drug problems, if you will.
I see. And what's hindering authorities from getting on top of this?
Coordination is a big one. We have police and customs liaisons in the countries. But what you find when you're on the ground there is what's lacking is a cohesion, a pulling together and having a plan. What is the strategy between Australia, New Zealand and the Pacific Islands? What are we doing collectively to say, how do we target this problem that's emerged and how do we stop it from getting worse?
Well, it's probably not clear on whose jurisdiction it is either. Like, at what point does it stop being a South American problem and start being a Pacific or Australian or New Zealand problem?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good observation, and it's one that I certainly found when I was there. There's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, and not clear who's making what meal. And we've seen that through challenges that presents building trust within the Pacific with the authorities, so that we can work collectively together. But I guess with the approach that we took when we were preparing these reports was to say, look, you know, we kind of need to cut through all of that, because at the end of the day, what these drugs are doing to Australia and to New Zealand is horrific.
And what kind of social impact is it having on the islands as well? Like, I'm sure it's infiltrated their social fabric to an extent.
You'd have to be pretty callous to be there and not see how challenging it is. You know, we sometimes forget, you know, how fortunate we are in places like New Zealand and Australia, how good we have got it. And then when you go to the Pacific and you see people struggling to find an income, and then you see this rise of this drug problem, not because they were demanding the drug, but because they happened to be halfway between the Americas and us. And so what's arisen, say, in places like Suva, which is relatively impoverished, you've got them taking on what's called Bluetoothing. So they're consuming the methamphetamine not by smoking it through pipes, as is commonly done in New Zealand, but injecting it. And so what you've seen is a large growth of methamphetamine addiction. And also together with that, because they're using needles, it's also seen a bump in HIV. So now you've got an AIDS epidemic along with a methamphetamine problem. And connected with that, you've also got mental health issues. So when you're talking with the rehabilitation services who are working there, they've just had this become overwhelmed with the introduction of these drugs, particularly in the last 5 years.
And just finally, you kind of did answer my last question in some ways, but are there any particular countries that are most in danger of really falling victim to this narco state sort of epidemic? I mean, Fiji would be one, but are there any others?
Fiji is the most likely, just because of its size, because of the nature of the ports. I mean, it is a coupling of some 350 islands. And so if you're looking to bring drugs across in either a submarine or a small vessel or a large vessel, sending a small vessel off to land, there's just so many opportunities. There's a lot of haystacks there for you to place your needle. And you've got a relatively impoverished workforce. So these customs officers, these police officers, are earning something around, say, 40,000 Fijian dollars a year. And if you have something like organized crime offer you the same amount of money you'd earn in a year to turn a blind eye to something. One of the things I heard when I was on the ground in Suva was the local New Zealand police officers being told by some Fijian officers that there was offers of bribes to just not go somewhere, not facilitate something, not opening a door, not like taking a bag off a carousel. Just don't be in a location at a particular time, and they could generate the same amount of income as they'd earn in a year.
That was Steve Simon, Chair of New Zealand's Ministerial Advisory Group on Transnational Serious and Organised Crime. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We go to Timor-Leste now, where today, the 12th of November, marks 34 years since soldiers opened fire on a crowd of demonstrators, killing more than 200 people. Survivors have gathered once again to remember that dark chapter in the nation's history, with calls for justice and an apology from the Indonesian government. Mize Fonseca is a survivor of that day, and she spoke to the ABC's Vonia Vieira.
What did you remember about the 12th of November and in the very important the event that you also there?
The memories, they are certainly very painful. I remember the sound of gunfire, the chaos, the screams of people and even strangers caught in the violence. We were at the cemetery marching peacefully from Motayel Church to honor those that were killed. But of course, that day, the Indonesian military attacked us without mercy. I saw in front of me so many falling, some shot, some was shamor trampled. I remember the fear, the confusion.
How has this event impacted your life and the lives of your family member?
Of course, it shattered our sense of security, of safety and trust in the world. The physical scars may have healed, but the emotional and psychological wounds, they are still there. The trauma we carry isn't just from the massacre itself, but from the years of occupation.
So what message that do you want to share with the future generation about that time?
I never forget that day on 12th of November 1991 and the years of suffering before and after that. Easy to think that the world moves on. Things are just history, but the pain and fight for justice live on. Our independence didn't come easily. It came with blood, sweat and tears. But it's also important to remember that peace is so fragile. While we fought for our independence, we must now work towards healing, probably reconciliation, and building a better future for all.
As a survivor, what do you believe is the most important step towards achieving justice and reconciliation?
The Indonesian government must fully recognize the events of that day and the atrocities committed, not just as a political gesture, but as a moral obligation. A public apology, in my personal humble opinion, is necessary, as well as efforts to ensure that those responsible are brought are held accountable, are brought to justice. But justice isn't only about punishment. It's also about healing. Reconciliation will not come without truth and accountability.
What kind of recognition or apology do you hope to receive from Indonesian government?
Well, I hope that a formal apology will be offered, one that acknowledges the pain and suffering caused by the massacre and the occupation of Timor-Leste. But of course, an apology alone is not enough. The apology must be backed with actions. The Indonesian government need to also recognize the history of the massacre in their educational curricula and ensuring that those who perpetrated, reconciliation is one thing, but making sure that who perpetrated those crimes are brought to justice.
That was Mize Fonseca, a survivor of the November 12 massacre, speaking there to the ABC's reporter in Dili, Vonia Vieira.
Pacific Beat.
As COP30 gets underway in Brazil, Pacific nations are questioning whether the global climate talks are able to deliver real results. This year's meeting in the Amazonian city of Belém has seen a lower turnout of Pacific leaders than in previous years. While Vanuatu has officials attending the summit, Minister for Climate Change, Raffragan Vanu, has stayed back in Port Vila. He joins us now to share his thoughts on the significance of COP and a way forward for climate change. And with that, I say welcome to the program, Minister.
Good morning.
Now, you are usually a regular on the COP circuit, but you've chosen to sit this one out this year. Why is that?
Well, actually, I am going, but I'll be going for the second week. So I'm arriving in Belém on Sunday evening, and I'll be there for the whole second week. And the reason is that is when the negotiations will be heating up. This first week is kind of a lot of side events. There's the high-level leaders, but I'm actually going more for the negotiations outcomes, which will be in the second week and will probably go beyond into the weekend as well. So I'm planning to stay longer than the official end of the meeting, because always the negotiations go a couple of days more.
I see. Now, that does make a lot of sense. I did read yesterday, actually, that it was unclear, just given how frictious this particular meeting was, if there would be any sort of resolutions towards the end of the meeting. Do you expect there to be some big results at this year's COP?
I don't expect there to be any big results. But as you say, yes, there is a lot of... It always comes down to the wire. What generally happens is that... A lot of the smaller delegations will leave on time and the negotiations will then be held in the late hours of the final weekend after the official closing. And at that time, we don't see many Pacific negotiators at the table or ministers because they've left. And so this time I'm making sure that I'm going to be there so that we can be actually try and see if we can influence the outcomes much more than we have maybe in previous years. I know in previous years we've been very disappointed. For example, at the last COP, the outcomes were gavelled without the Pacific Island nations in the room, and we made a protest about that. But yeah, the actual way in which negotiations are conducted and who's in the room and what inputs are taken on board and which ones are not is always very political. And as always, seems to be always sort of stacked against us.
Yes, well, you have publicly said that there are low expectations for this year's COP. Why do you hold that position?
I hold that position based on previous experience, right? We haven't had any good outcomes really from COP for a long time. Back in Sharm el-Sheikh, for example, we got the big win there was actually acknowledging a loss and damage and agreeing to establish a fund, which was only then established like last year. This year, obviously, the big thing is the NDCs. And already we've seen very low ambition NDCs, actually nothing like what we need from countries to submit. And that's why the Association of Small Island States, which the Pacific is part of, have actually put up a new agenda item to actually talk about the NDCs and the lack of ambition and how we're going to achieve what we want in terms of what the science requires from improving or somehow going back to countries and saying you have to actually increase your NDC to align with Paris targets of 1.5.
I mean, well, this year's summit literally opened with the UN climate chief urging countries to cooperate and not fight each other. I guess with that in mind, it sounds like COP is losing a little bit of its influence. Do you think it's become less important to the Pacific's fight against climate change?
No, it's not. It's not less important. And the reason is we are in the Pacific, obviously, we're at the front lines of climate change. It's the greatest threat to our livelihoods and future. And so we have to be in all these forums. And the UNFCCC obviously is the convention of the United Nations that's supposed to deal with climate change. As the ICJ said in its advisory opinion in July, all the UN conventions and all the machinery of the UN is all premised on every country addressing climate change and making some effort to deal with it, to reduce emissions and to assist other countries to get across the line. And that's something that has kind of changed the landscape this year, because it's not just UNFCCC now. It's all countries have obligations under all international law to deal with climate change. But still, this is the UN's appointed forum, and so we have to be there. And that's why I think you can see a large presence from the Pacific Island countries. A number of my colleague ministers have been there from the beginning and are there now. And we will continue to try and see if we can get the greatest ambition, the greatest levels of ambition in the outcomes from this meeting.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with Minister Vanuatu's Minister for Climate Change, Ralph Fregonvanu, who's not in Brazil at the moment, but he will be heading to Brazil for the second week of the COP30 summit. Now, Vanuatu and you yourself drove the campaign for the International Court of Justice advisory and said states are responsible for the impacts. Sorry, the advisory which said states are responsible for the impacts of climate change. Should this be a key part of the COP discussions, do you think?
Well, the implications should be right there in the middle of everything we're talking about, because the advisory opinion made it very clear that states are legally obligated under international law to meet the 1.5 degree target that was set in Paris, and also to have obligations for international cooperation to meet the climate finance objectives that were set in Paris also. And right now we're off both those targets. And now the ICJ has made it very clear that states are legally obligated. It changes the dynamic in the negotiation room, because it's no longer this sort of voluntary charitable thing you do if you want to be nice. It's actually a requirement of you as a state. And we're hoping that we'll see that reflected. I don't hold high hopes for that, but at least we have another sort of tool in our kit of arguments we can make to try and push ambition from the high-emitting states.
And looping back to COP, if Australia and the Pacific wins the bid to host COP31, do you think a regional COP would make a practical difference for Pacific communities?
I think it would make a difference in terms of bringing the attention of the world to the situation in the Pacific Islands and in Australia, and also particularly we're hoping in terms of climate finance, bringing all the climate finance big guys into the Pacific. And we're actually hoping that if Australia and the Pacific win the bid, we are able to have some sort of pre-COP climate finance meeting in the Pacific to try and get financing for our transition from fossil fuel dependent economies to economies that are purely run on renewable energy. And that is a big objective we've set ourselves in the Pacific, to be one of the first regions of the world to transition to renewable energy. And for that, obviously, we need a deal of financing. And that's what we're hoping, that if the Pacific COP is approved, we will see this as an outcome, bringing the finance into the region to fund this strategy of a just transition to renewable energy across the region.
Well, just on that bit, our expert from Greenpeace, who we had on the show yesterday, said the hosting rights would be decided by the end of the summit. Do you expect Australia to be awarded it within the next couple of weeks?
Well, the Pacific has been putting all our weight behind the bid, the joint bid by Australia and the Pacific. And as your expert said, this will have to be decided by the end of next week. I don't know what's going to happen. We're seeing Turkey's not making any moves to step down. But really, I mean, it's now up to the Western European and others group, which is the group that Europe and Australia is in, who are supposed to choose the next host. It's really an internal matter for them now. In these last days, they've got to sit down together, particularly Australia and Turkey, and make some compromise, or I don't know how they're going to solve it. But really, it's in their camp to do it. We are simply outside watching them. We've made all our overtures. The Pacific Island leaders have repeatedly, at the highest level, said that we support Australia to get the bid. Unfortunately, at the General Assembly earlier this year in September, we were not allowed to come into the room in terms of meeting Turkey. So we've said what we've said, but now it's really up to Australia and Turkey and the other Western European countries to find some way to agree on one single host by the end of next week.
Well, given both Australia's leader and Turkey's leader aren't attending the summit, do you think we can read anything into that, given that maybe both leaders don't know if they're going to be successful for the bid or not, and therefore maybe don't want to be there to save face?
I don't want to comment on that.
Fair enough. And just finally, what would you like to see Australia focus on, you know, if it does host COP31, particularly in terms of representing Pacific voices and priorities?
We keep saying this. Australia needs to get off the fossil fuel pipeline it's on. Australia, there was a study just released before COP. Australia is one of the four countries in the world who have ramped up fossil fuel production the most since, you know, in the last years since Paris. So Australia is one of the big high emitters. And this is particularly in terms of the fossil fuel exports that are growing. Australia's just increased the life of, Western Australia, the gas line there. They're continuing to expand fossil fuel production. And that is something that Australia can't do as a global citizen. And that was clear from the ICJ advisory opinion. They have a legal obligation to get off, to stop, to reduce emissions. It's not just domestic anymore. It's now all emissions, including exports. And this is the big difference the advisory opinion has made. You can't just count your domestic emissions, as we've been doing in the past, and saying, yes, we're on the net zero path. You've actually got to count everything you put out. And for Australia, the elephant in the room, obviously, is all the fossil fuel exports that are ramping up. And that's a clear ask we've asked of Australia many times. And it needs to tackle that.
No, it absolutely does. Mr. Regenvani, that's all we've got time for on Pacific Beat today. But I want to thank you for coming on the program and having a chat with us.
Thank you.
That was Vanuatu's Climate Minister, Ralph Regenvani.
multiple centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, the Australian government has come under fire over a secret visit to Parliament by Nauru's President David Adiang. The unannounced visit comes as Australia resumes sending immigration detainees back to the Pacific nation. There have also been allegations of bikie gangs being used to provide security at the detention centre in Nauru. Stephen Jedgetts is the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, and he's been keeping a close eye on this story. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Morning, Kyle. Good to be with you.
Likewise. Has there been any word from the Australian government why the visit from Nauru's president was kept a secret?
Yeah, well, look, the Australian government argues that this wasn't a quote-unquote secret visit. They just say that they didn't necessarily get around to announcing it. Now, it might sound like a fine distinction, and it's certainly not an explanation that necessarily cuts it with the government's opponents. But their argument has been, look, there was essentially what they are calling a private visit by David Adiang, by the president, or at least a visit that wasn't necessarily a bilateral official one. Now, that explanation, as I say, is one that people inside the coalition and the Greens say doesn't pass the sniff test, because in the end, this was, a visit to Parliament House by the leader of a nation, which is in many ways quite important to Australia. And given the enormous controversy that surrounds a large number of things at the moment, including not just the agreement for the NZYQ cohort to be resettled there, but also the broader controversy which emerged over the weekend with this report of bikie gangs providing security allegedly for former detainees on Nauru. They say that there should have been much more transparency. Now, it's worth saying that we still don't know exactly what was discussed yesterday by Mr. Adiang and Tony Burke, the Minister for Home Affairs. Mr. Burke put out a very brief statement on social media afterwards, saying that he had a good meeting with Mr. Adiang and that the two countries had to talk about a range of critical issues, but he didn't go into any detail. Mr. Adiang and the government of Nauru also haven't provided any detail about the meeting. So it's very difficult for us to say exactly what happened behind closed doors. We know that the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, also met with David Adiang, and that she did raise the, quote, media reports with him. That seems to be a reference to those claims about bikie gangs. But the reality is there is still an awful lot of mystery about exactly what happened for much of this visit.
An awful lot of mystery indeed. Now, the resumption of sending detainees back to Nauru is pretty controversial, but the spotlight has been on Nauru all week following revelations that bikies have been hired to provide security on the island. Has anyone addressed these reports yet?
Well, not directly, in the sense that we haven't yet got a whole lot of clarity, certainly none from the government of Nauru, about exactly what's going on here. These allegations have been made by a whistleblower, and they were published by the Nine newspapers over the weekend. As of yet, there hasn't been any formal comment from the government of Nauru about this. The Australian government, for its part, has said a couple of things. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said a couple of days ago that it was his understanding that most of these issues, as he read them, came largely under the former government. That's not, just for what it's worth, that doesn't seem to be what's conveyed by the story, but that's the argument that the Prime Minister makes, that this predates his government. And then we do know, as I mentioned, that the Foreign Minister raised this issue with David Adiang when she met with him earlier this week. But we still don't really have clarity about exactly how far these allegations go, whether the government of Nauru is doing anything about them. Exactly how much money was allegedly paid to these subcontractors linked to bikie gangs or who are part of bikie gangs, or where the situation sits right now. So again, not much clarity around this at all.
Well, it certainly raises some eyebrows, that is for sure. How do you think this visit connects to the broader NZYQ cohort resettlement deal between Australia and Nauru, especially given we know some people have already been sent over?
Yeah, we don't have a precise idea of exactly how many people have been sent over. We know some have. The latest suggestion seems to be around four or five people or so, potentially, who have been sent over. But we don't have absolute clarity on this. It's clear the government wants to send over more people. Ideally, it would like to send many, most, or even perhaps all of the NZYQ cohort. So that's more than 350 people. Just to jog memories of listeners, this is the cohort of former detainees who were released due to a High Court order in Australia after it found they could not continue to be detained. These are people who, by and large, have either failed character tests and therefore have no right to stay in Australia, or who have been convicted of fairly serious crimes, sometimes very serious crimes. It's a cohort of people the government says have no right to stay in Australia, and it wants to find a way to essentially expel them from Australia. But the difficulty is that in all of these cases, the countries that are their countries of origin or countries where they have, for example, citizenship, are not willing to take them. So that's why the government has come up with this very contentious idea to send them to Nauru instead, at a very substantial cost to the Australian taxpayer. So that's the background here. Now, we know that there are an ongoing set of legal processes underway in Australia. Refugee advocates and others say they will continue to fight it. We also know that there's just huge amounts of secrecy around these arrangements. Just as one example, David Adiang, when this was first announced, gave an interview in the local language in Nauru when he was speaking to the public. We know for a fact that DFAT did its own informal translation of that interview, but has refused to release it to the ABC and to other media, saying it could damage the relationship with Nauru. So even an informal translation of a public statement made by the president of Nauru has been deemed too sensitive to put out into the public arena. All of that speaks, I guess, to the fact that whilst this process is underway, there's still an awful lot about it that is clouded in mystery and uncertainty. And you would say it's very likely, perhaps almost certain, that this NZYQ cohort and next steps from here would have been discussed by David Adiang and Tony Burke when they met, potentially very likely discussed with Penny Wong and Pat Conroy as well. But we simply don't have clarity because, as I say, the government hasn't yet provided it.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of mystery indeed. And Dizzy, just quickly before we go, because we are running out of time, but what do you think the political fallout for Anthony Albanese will be from yesterday's visit, particularly given Labor has already been accused of secrecy over this deal?
Well, unsurprisingly, refugee advocates, the Coalition and the Greens have all come out to criticise the government over the level of secrecy here. It's worth pointing out, there's not political uniformity on this. The Greens and refugee advocates are very critical of the government for its decision to send the cohort overseas, arguing it's barbaric and inhumane. The Coalition agrees there's too much secrecy, but is actually on board with the deportations. They say these people should be expelled from Australia, so they back the government on that. Their argument is simply that the government hasn't been transparent enough about exactly how it's doing it and the cost to the Australian taxpayer. So there is still, as I say, a level of political controversy in this. And I guess in a sense, it's unsurprising that this unannounced secret visit by David Adiang to Parliament garnered a lot of political attention, with both the Greens and the Coalition saying it was another bit of evidence that the government was shrouding this entire operation in secrecy. Both sides are calling for much more clarity from the Albanese government.
Yeah, they certainly haven't pulled any punches, that's for sure. Stephen, thanks very much for that insight, and thanks so much for joining us today on Pacific Beat.
No worries. Thanks, Kyle.
That was Stephen Jedgetts, the ABC's foreign affairs reporter. It is Wednesday, November 12, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, filling in for Agi Tupou today. And if you're just tuning in, it's been a huge show so far, with a new report outlining how gang members are transporting shipments of drugs through the Pacific Islands with the help of corrupt police and custom officials.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. And across the Pacific, internet connectivity has been boosted by a network of undersea fibre optic cables put in place by governments and donors. But it's high above us in the sky, where a network of low orbiting satellites operated by Starlink are shaping the way Pacific Islanders are accessing the internet. While Starlink has transformed some countries, it has remained illegal in other parts. Joining us for more on this story is Dr. Amanda Watson from the Australian National University. Doctor, welcome to the program.
G'day, thanks for having me.
Not a problem at all. So why is Starlink so divisive for Pacific governments, and why do some open countries like Fiji accept it with open arms while others have shut it out like a virus?
Yes, well, it's a new technology, so it presents a challenge for regulators because it's quite different to how previous technologies have operated. So with other technologies such as mobile networks, the telecommunication regulators sell spectrum to those operators, and therefore that generates some revenue for those governments. And for small Pacific governments, that can be quite a chunk of their revenue that comes in through those spectrum sales. So with Starlink, it's quite a different way of operating because Starlink sells direct to consumer. And so this is something that has been a challenge for regulators to decide how they're going to respond to this new technology and new way of operating in terms of internet provision.
So in some ways, it sounds like a bit of a disruptor. And is that the sort of the reason why, I guess, there's so much opposition to it?
Yes, and it's been something quite new, and governments and telecommunication regulators have had different concerns or uncertainties about it. So, for instance, in Samoa, when they originally banned Starlink in January last year, they were raising questions about national security, and I think in various countries, including in Tonga, I've heard people talk about queries about cybersecurity. So there's various questions that people have had, and I think mainly it's the newness of the technology, the novelty of it, and just various different questions and concerns that have been raised in response.
Well, let's talk about the Samoa example, because it's a pretty good case study, because Starlink was banned there in 2024 but was approved a year later. What happened in that 12-month span to allow the Office of the Regulator to approve Starlink?
Well, the short answer to that is that the regulator was in negotiations with Starlink, and they ended up reaching a place where Starlink users can pay in Samoa and Tala for their internet connections, their monthly fees, through different resellers in the country. And so they ended up being quite happy with the outcome. The negotiations included things such as the regulator pointing out that a lot of Samoans don't have credit cards, and therefore they can't easily, pay through Starlink's usual mechanisms. So in the end, it sort of turned out well, and the approval was granted in January this year. But during the interim, over that 13-month period from the initial banning of it in January last year to the approval in January this year, there were quite a few different turns and changes in the policy and different announcements. And it would have been, I think, quite confusing for Samoan individuals and businesses who were considering using Starlink and trying to understand what was permissible.
That's so interesting, because in Niue, there's been an outright ban, which is curious given Niue's remote and isolated geography. Would you think there'd be more demand for services like Starlink in a place like that?
So in Niue, yes, we thought it had been banned. But interestingly, in July this year, the Minister of Finance has said that a final decision is yet to be made. So we may, in fact, see some movement in Niue. I'm not sure whether negotiations are underway between Starlink and the government or regulator in Niue, but we may see some shifts there based on what the Minister of Finance said.
Interesting. Well, French Polynesia, New Caledonia and Papua New Guinea are all in a somewhat similar boat. Actually, in PNG, there is a legal case there. Do these territories have or share a similar reason for not wanting to approve Starlink?
No, I think it's different in each case. In Papua New Guinea, the Minister of Communication, the Honourable Timothy Massieu, announced that Starlink had been granted a licence, and then subsequent to that, the Ombudsman Commission took out court proceedings to halt the issuing of that licence, and we're waiting to hear the judge's decision in that case. So I think in each country it's quite different.
Yeah, very interesting. Apologies if this is a sort of a naive question, but I guess it sounds like a reason for a lot of the controversy around Starlink. It's because they look to have somewhat of a monopoly over this industry, if you'd call it. Why isn't there sort of much competition?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because, in fact, what they're doing in a number of the countries where they are operating with resellers is that the resellers, such as Digicel and Vodafone in a number of countries, are actually places where the Starlink users can pay their monthly fees for data. So in Fiji, Samoa, Solomon Islands, Tonga and Vanuatu, there are these resellers. So that means that, in effect, for, say, companies such as OneTok Tonga or different companies like that, Satsol in Solomon Islands, it's just another product that they're offering in a suite of offerings to their to people wanting to connect to the internet and be able to use the internet for business or pleasure. Then these companies are simply offering that as another one of their offerings. So in those countries, that's how it's operating. As we've said, in some of the other countries, it's not currently legal to use Starlink. So there's a huge variety of differences between the different Pacific Island countries.
Oh, well, for what it's worth, I did use Starlink when I was in Vanuatu, and I got to say, I was really, really impressed by it. Dr. Watson, that's all we've got time for on Pacific Beat today, but thanks so much for joining us and offering some of that clarity and insight.
Thanks very much for having me along.
Not a problem at all. That was Dr. Amanda Watson from the Australian National University.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We're going to end with some sport now, and the PNG Kumuls could be taking on England ahead of the Rugby League World Cup next year if PNG's head coach, Jason Demetriou, has his way. After the team retained the Pacific Championships Bowl for the third year in a row with convincing wins over Cook Islands and Fiji, they have nothing scheduled until the World Cup, and Demetriou would like to see that situation change. And now that he has taken on the coaching role at the London Broncos in the English Championship, the pool of Kumuls playing in the UK is set to rise with Morea and Finlay Glare having already signed on. In the meantime, reflecting on the Pacific Championships, Demetriou says that competition is in need of an overhaul after PNG were denied the chance to take on Tonga and compete for the right to take on Australia next year.
You know, we knew going into it that we weren't going to have the third match, but as it played out, I think it would have been a cracking game, PNG v Tonga, and we'd have come in with a lot of confidence and they were probably down a little bit. So I think it would have definitely added to the weekend, that's for sure. We grew as the series went on and we played the footy we've been working towards over the last 2 years. So that sets us up nicely for the World Cup.
Certainly, you didn't have to look too far on social media to see that the fans were calling for that game between the Kumuls and Tonga to take place. I mean, is it time for the NRL to take a look at the Pacific Championship and look at revising it and coming up with the model that satisfies everybody's needs? Because up to now, they don't seem to have done that.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Particularly when it comes to PNG. Like, there's no doubt the biggest growth area in our game is going to be Papua New Guinea. The wealth of talent that'll come out of there over the next couple of years. If this year's Pac Champs wasn't an example of that, you saw the emergence of Maraya, Goro, Faro, Cooper, Bai, you know, these kind of players. You know, Cooper obviously has grown up in Australia, but the other boys, you know, Finlay Glare is another one. Born and bred in Papua New Guinea, have come through the Hunter system under Paul Aiton, who's done a fantastic job. So we need to create more opportunities for these guys to play on the world stage. And, you know, obviously a World Cup next year does that. But in between, when you're playing the same team year in, year out, I know Fiji and the Cook Islands feel the same. It's almost benefiting Tonga and Samoa and Australia, but it's not really supporting the other nations that we're getting left behind a little bit. So, yeah, I'm sure it's something that the game will look at over the next 12 months.
So when can we expect to see the Kumuls in action again? Will it be the World Cup or will there be an opportunity to play before then?
I would love a game against England in the international break. I think the majority of our Kumul side will be over in England. So I think that would be a great hit out for both teams as a preparation to the World Cup. I'll have to get CEO and Tony Archer onto that and speak to the officials in England. But yeah, just watching on the weekend and, you know, the lack of games or quality games that the English are getting, I think it'd be a good sell and it'd be a good game too. So yeah, I'd love to get a mid-season game against those guys. If not, it'll be a two-week prep leading into first game in the World Cup. And the good thing about the last 2 years is we've used 29, 30 players across the 2 years and given some great exposure to a lot of players. So the competition for places is going to be really strong, and having some continuity with the coach and the staff is going to help the boys when they come into camp as well.
How does London Broncos fit into the picture now that you've taken over the job as coach there? You've already recruited Maraya and Finlay Glare to your side for the next season in England. Is it going to be a sort of pathway for PNG players? I mean, clearly they have to be up to standard, but maybe there are going to be quite a few who'll be looking for a bit of assistance from you now.
Yeah, definitely. And there'll be more to come in that. We've signed some more over the next week or so. There'll be more announcements around. Our boys are more than up to it. And I think for them, the opportunity to go abroad and experience a different way of living, a different culture, is only going to add to their appeal from NRL clubs. And I think there's a misconception around Papua New Guinea boys. I say this all the time, you know, you get one player who comes over who's lazy and doesn't want to work hard and has a bad attitude in terms of his ability to commit or has a bit of an issue in and around the language, then unfortunately that casts a shadow over every player. And my experience with the PNG boys has been exceptional. I've worked with Goro Faro this year, and my understanding was his ability to communicate was difficult because his language barrier, he speaks the language from his village. And so when he came into the Hunters camp, he had to learn Tok Pisin, and then he had to learn to speak English as well. And while that's growing, his ability as a footballer is second to none. His ability to adapt and learn and take on board what you're asking him to do is as good as any player I've ever seen. And you know, I remember watching Lachie Lamb spend 10 minutes with him after training. I think it was on a Wednesday, and then we came back on the Friday, and he just took everything that he spoke about after that and put it into practice, and was pretty impressive to see. And I know the players around him, the senior players, particularly in our Royal boys, they were shocked at how quickly he was able to grasp the footy side of things. So I think the talent is there. For me, it's about showcasing PNG talent and their ability to play at a high level. So those boys I know that we sign will come over and they'll showcase what PNG is all about.
Will it help that you are the coach? And the way you've just spoken about PNG players there is something that ordinarily they wouldn't get if they went to England. And that's certainly been a problem over the years, perhaps a lack of empathy, if you like.
Yeah, I think so. I think it definitely helps. You go to a club where you're familiar with the coach, and it's probably part of the reason why you go to the club. So I feel like I've got a good understanding of how they develop as players and their values as people. And I think once you know that, you're able to connect with them pretty well. And every player that I've spoken to and ask if they're interested in coming, they can't wait to get on the plane. And that's a good sign for London. It's a good sign for the game over there as well. But there isn't many, if any, that I can think of off the top of my head of Papua New Guinea born and bred players since Justin Mullen retired that are playing in the NRL. And I think that's the tragedy, really, because there's so much talent over there. But I think what the NRL bid's doing over there and what the Hunters have done through Paul Aiton over the last few years, I can't stress that enough. He's been outstanding in terms of developing these players that come really raw into his system. It's a hotbed for sure. And the great thing about the English game is the Papua New Guineans, interestingly, because of the climate difference, absolutely love the UK. Edwin Apapo is a great example of that at the moment. He's one of the best players in the competition.
That was Jason Demetrio, PNG Kumul's head coach and now in charge of the English Championship side, London Broncos as well. And he was talking there with Richard Ewart. Let's hope he can facilitate a game between the Kumuls and England because, look, next year is too long to wait for the next time for the Kumuls to get onto the park, if you ask me.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main stories. Vanuatu's climate change minister, Ralph Reganvanu, says he'll be heading to COP in its second week to make sure there's Pacific representation in the final negotiations.
And at that time, we don't see many Pacific negotiators at the table or ministers because they've left. And so this time I'm making sure that I'm going to be there so that we can actually try and see if we can influence the outcome.
I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. That'll be with Richard Hewitt. Stay tuned, though, on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily. You'll find all our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. My name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic day.